Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Today on the show, after 40 years, the Wyoming Department of Education is phasing out a program to support migrant students. Some people are not impressed.
I think it shows very little forethought, compassion.
Local government in the state want a more stable source of revenue.
Being able to ensure that those funds that are needed to provide those expected services are there.
A story about the move from federal to state management of Yellowstone grizzly bears and how the debate isn't over quite yet.
Been there, done it, seen it. We're not going to say it's done until it's done.
And a look at how efforts to remove DACA could impact Wyoming. Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Wyoming's lawmakers just returned to Washington after a summer break that President Trump urged the Senate to cut short to take up more of his agenda. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington on what Wyoming lawmakers think they can accomplish this fall.
While the nation's lawmakers took most of August off from their legislative duties in Washington, the president tweeted at Senate Republicans to get back to the nation's capital to work on health care reform. But then the hurricane started hitting. Senate Budget Chair Mike Enzi voted against the funding bill. Enzi says he's trying to get Washington to set up a rainy day fund just like Wyoming has.
Those are emergencies we already have a precedent for doing. I've said since I got here that there needs to be a budget item that puts away money each year for those disasters so that when the disasters happen, we already have the money. We haven't spent it already. And it doesn't add to the deficit then.
In the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, President Trump cut a deal with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer to fund the government, the storm victims, and to extend the debt ceiling until December. Enzi doesn't like short-term spending deals, but before the vote, Enzi said he was fine with the deal.
That's just part of the operation to get something done. And 3 months isn't a big policy deal.
But eventually, Enzi opposed the bill. Other Republicans hate the short-term deal Trump struck with Democratic leaders over the groans of GOP leaders. Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins says it seems Democrats won that round.
I was very surprised at the deal that was struck. Usually when you have disagreement with the Republicans on one side and the Democrats on the other, you split the difference. So I was surprised.
Now that Congress has returned, Enzi is also holding out hope that the GOP can still cobble together a health reform bill this fall.
Went through a series of hearings this morning on health care that look like there's going to be some bipartisan solutions, both the short term and then, assuming that works, to get into a longer term situation.
The failure of the Obamacare repeal effort before the August recess still stings the president and many Republicans. That has senior Republicans like Enzi looking for a longer term solution, though freshman Republicans like Georgia Senator David Perdue are chomping at the bit to get the party in line on Obamacare repeal.
Well, I think the health care vote shows we were very fractured. We lost three chairmen to that vote, you know. So this is a question of is the Republican Party going to govern? Or are we going to sit here and vote our own personal interest? And right now, personal interest is outweighing the national interest. And sooner or later, that we have to come to grips with that.
But an effort has emerged by Republicans Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Bill Cassidy of Louisiana to basically block grant most of Obamacare's Medicaid expansion and health care subsidies directly to the states. Wyoming's junior Senator John Barrasso likes the contours of the proposal.
Well, the idea is there's a lot of money still sitting overseas because our tax situation in the past has encouraged jobs to go overseas. We want to bring the money back and the jobs back and put them both to work here in America.
Like most in the GOP, Barrasso doesn't seem to be as focused on health reform as he was in July. As chair of the Infrastructure Committee, he's hoping the president's tax reform proposal can be coupled together with a plan for repatriation, the idea to bring hundreds of billions of dollars back to the U.S. soil to invest in American infrastructure.
And the issue continues to be the same. We want to make decisions at home in Wyoming, not have Washington dictate. We want Wyoming to decide. So with what Senators Graham and Cassidy are talking about, which are getting decisions out of Washington and the money and the decisions and the flexibility home to each of your states is what I'd like to do. I want to get that stuff back to Wyoming, and I support that.
While many Republicans are still upset that Trump reached across the aisle this week, the party is still upbeat it can get key parts of its agenda to the president's desk this fall. The problem for many in the GOP is that now many Democrats think they can too. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
On Tuesday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, also known as DACA, would be phased out. Susie Pritchett is an associate professor and the director of the Family and Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wyoming College of Law. She spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen about how DACA came to be, its relevance to Wyoming, and what is now at stake for its recipients.
The enactment of DACA by President Obama was an interesting move because normally changes in immigration law happen at the congressional level and they happen through the normal legislative process. And in fact, we call DACA recipients dreamers because there was proposed legislation. For the past 16 years, there's been various legislative proposals that are working to give these children who came to the United States, usually with parents, usually through no fault of their own, unlawfully, some sort of permanent immigration status. And unfortunately, Congress just hasn't been able to come to an agreement on that. And so it wasn't necessarily a grant of immigration status, but it was a promise from the federal government and from Immigration and Customs Enforcement not to actively deport these dreamers during the time they have this DACA status, and then to allow them to obtain permission to work lawfully, which opens up so many other doorways in our country.
So who are these DACA recipients living in Wyoming?
It's really interesting. So I actually, just before I came in today, looked up the statistics, and there's about 600 individuals in Wyoming who have applied for and been granted DACA. So it's not a small number. And I've had the pleasure of getting to know some of these kids. We say kids, but a lot of them are young adults. They're students here at the university. They're graduate students. They're working in our state. They're, you know, part of our tourism industry. They're working in our oil and gas industry. They're students who are going to our public schools and benefiting from the amazing educational opportunities we have at the K-12 level here. And because our public schools at the K-12 level have a constitutional obligation to educate anyone, regardless of their immigration status, we're pouring loads of money into these kids to make sure they receive the finest education here in Wyoming. And they really are part of the fabric of our state.
As I understand it, a lot of dreamers didn't know they were unauthorized until they were teenagers when their documented peers started doing things that they weren't able to. Their peers were driving, they were getting after school jobs, they were applying for federal financial aid for college. One thing that you have written about that you say these immigrants have not been able to access is the Hathaway Scholarship here in Wyoming. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So the Hathaway Scholarship has a statute in our state statutes that applies directly to it and outlines the eligibility criteria for who can qualify for the Hathaway. And the statute clearly states that anybody who doesn't hold citizenship or lawful permanent resident status, which is synonymous with having a green card, is ineligible for the Hathaway. And so even students who now have the DACA status or are enrolled in this DACA program and have a good Social Security number, have work authorization, have a Wyoming state driver's license, graduated from Wyoming schools, they are ineligible for the generous Hathaway scholarship. And so from my interactions with a lot of DACA students here at the university, that's been a massive financial obstacle.
So it sounds like life without immigration status in the U.S. is just as much about missing out on some of these opportunities, but also it seems to be marked by this fear of deportation. Do you think these changes to DACA will heighten that effect?
I mean, it's certainly, it doesn't take a huge stretch of the imagination to put yourself in one of these kids' shoes, right? One day you're going to the university, you think you're working toward a four-year degree, you have a work permit, you have a part-time job that's allowing you to pay your tuition and go to school, and you're really taking steps toward the American dream. And the next thing you know, DACA is gone. And because these kids do not have any status, they are immediately deportable. And know, ICE could come to their door the day after DACA expires and knock on their door and take them in to ICE detention and put them in deportation proceedings.
So switching gears just a little bit, in 2012, when Obama enacted DACA, it was after Congress was not able to pass the DREAM Act. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has come out and said that that decision was unconstitutional. He called it, I believe, unlawful overreach. On the other hand, you have the American Civil Liberties Union saying that the decision by President Trump to abandon DACA was a political one and not a legal one. What do you make of all that?
There's so many interesting things going on that raise questions about what is the proper delegation of authority between Congress and the executive branch. This certainly was an executive action carried out by President Obama in the face of legislative inaction. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions says that the federal government cannot defend it. There's no constitutional basis or authority by which the president had to take that action to begin with. Interestingly, juxtaposed to that discussion is President Trump's travel ban, which came out shortly after his inauguration. That, too, was an executive action taken without congressional approval in the area of immigration. And it will be interesting to see in the days to come as these issues make their way through the courts whether or not there's a distinction between exercising prosecutorial discretion the way that President Obama did and working, you know, under different legislative provisions that give the president a wide latitude and amount of authority in the area of protecting national security, which was the justification for the travel ban. So I think those are issues that are not clear. They're certainly not clear, and the courts are going to be wrestling with them over the months and years to come.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today. Susie Pritchett is an associate professor with the College of Law at the University of Wyoming. She's also director of the Family and Immigrant Justice Clinic on campus.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, the Inside Energy team looks at uranium. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. The U.S. used to be the world's number one uranium producer, and most of it came from Wyoming. But since the 1980s, production has fallen off a cliff. Prices are at rock bottom. That may be about to change, though. Uranium's biggest customer is the nuclear energy industry. In coming years, hundreds of new reactors are planned for China and India. Uranium companies in the U.S. are hoping to gear up for a boom. Inside Energy's Madeline Beck reports.
It's a silvery white metal that's heavy. Very heavy. In fact, it's one of the heaviest elements on Earth, with one cup of the stuff weighing nearly 10 pounds. And uranium doesn't have the best reputation. People remember incidents like those at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. Here's an old ABC News clip.
Radiation levels 10 times normal from Finland all the way down to Stockholm.
While those incidents are extremely rare, they can be extremely dangerous and have a huge impact on the uranium market. Every time there's a nuclear accident, nuclear energy goes out of favor, plants are shut down, there's a uranium glut, prices drop. Uranium's latest price meltdown followed the accident in 2011 at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan. In the aftermath, Japan powered down 54 nuclear reactors and sold off already purchased uranium onto the world market, driving prices into the floor.
U.S. uranium production is at a level we haven't seen in decades.
That's Scott Melby of Uranium Energy Corp.
We've got to hunker down and survive in what is one of the most difficult market periods that I've seen in my career.
Melby spoke at the recent Global Uranium Symposium in Casper, Wyoming.
But if we can position ourselves to be ready to respond when prices turn, I think it'll be very good news for everyone in this room.
A price turn. That's exactly what most in the room are anticipating. China and India combined are building 26 reactors and plan to build nearly 250 more in the coming years. And that's going to take a lot of uranium. Add to that support from the Trump administration for a revived nuclear industry in this country. So some industry analysts are predicting that prices, now in the 20s per pound, may go as high as 80 in the next 5 years. Wyoming's smaller, low-cost uranium operations will have an edge when that happens, Melby said, speaking outside the Uranium Symposium.
Well, I think clearly we'll be leading U.S. production. Wyoming has a core of producers already in place. So, you know, you have the ability to increase pretty dramatically.
I'm driving with William Goranson of Energy Fuels to the Nichols Ranch, one of the uranium mines waiting on that price hike.
I feel like this is my third time I've gone through business cycle where we're always on scraping by with our nails to stay alive.
One of the ways his and many other U.S. companies are able to stay alive is by in-situ mining. What that looks like at Nichols is hundreds of tan boxes dotting the mine property. The process is largely automated. A water solution is pumped underground through each of these tan boxes to dissolve the uranium, then pumped back up, and through a series of steps, uranium is separated out. Goranson said they're ready to ramp up production and develop new areas as soon as prices start recovering.
Won't be at double, but we'll be building capacity into double production.
They're not the only ones. At least four other companies are also buying up or shaping up Wyoming properties, like Scott Melby's company, Uranium Energy Corp. They just purchased a mine in northeast Wyoming, and he's got
1 foot on the brake and 1 foot on the gas.
He says for now, his company is just sitting on the assets, waiting for the market tide to turn.
I think we're setting up for that. It's inevitable. I don't know if it's imminent, but it is inevitable.
The uranium industry still has a rocky road ahead. Experts and industry vets estimated that uranium prices will start to really come back between 2020 and 2025. That's a long time to be uncertain. But a price hike, if it comes, could mean not only a boost to producers, but to U.S. energy security. Nuclear energy accounts for 20% of the nation's electricity. Even so, right now nearly 80% of the uranium needed for those plants comes from other countries, like Russia, Canada, and Kazakhstan. For Inside Energy, I'm Madeline Beck.
Superfund cleanups are a priority for Scott Pruitt, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. He wants to cut through red tape that has left more than 1,000 sites still contaminated, with everything from radioactive waste to lead. He also wants to remove sites that have already been cleaned up from the so-called National Priority List, which has more than 1,300 sites. Inside Energy's Dan Boyce visited a town in western Colorado that's been on that list since 1986.
It's after hours in the dark main room of the Rimrocker Historical Society.
This is a Geiger counter.
Jane Thompson is showing off what put this part of Colorado on the map. It's clicking because of this radioactive yellow rock in an antique jar close by.
Carnotite ore is what they milled here.
Move the jar closer and that clicking picks up.
It's got uranium, vanadium, and radium in it.
Thompson is president of the Historical Society, and she also helps spearhead an annual picnic some 15 minutes up the road, a reunion picnic at the site of her hometown.
Hello, Yerevan!
A few dozen people have gathered under trees and canopies in an otherwise hot, empty field on this late August day.
The things that happened here were very important.
Yerevan, a tiny mining company town, provided uranium for nuclear weapons developed during the Manhattan Project.
And even though the town is gone, we feel like that history of those people need to be kept.
Yerevan, that little town where Thompson grew up, it is gone. Not just the mill, where those yellow rocks were processed into so-called yellow cake uranium ore.
Everything is gone.
Literally.
Every house, every tree.
The swimming pool, the rec center.
Everything was dug up, shredded, and buried in a big hole on top of the hill.
Decades and decades of mining left Yerevan contaminated with radioactive chemicals and heavy metals. The EPA declared it a Superfund site in the 80s and ordered the mining company to start clearing away the entire town. You'd never know this picnic area was once a community of about 1,000 people. Today you just see the bottom of a crumbling sandstone river valley.
I didn't know it was dangerous. I didn't know it'd hurt you.
91-year-old Larry Cooper sits in a camping chair, wearing suspenders and breathing with the help of an oxygen tank. He worked in the mills and mines around Yerevan starting in the 50s, and his health suffered.
I got cancer. I lost half of my lung on the right side.
Registered nurse Joanna Godwin says it's very common for former Yerevan workers. She's here with a nonprofit called Nuclear Care Partners. They provide free health care through the Department of Labor for medical issues that can be traced back to the mining of radioactive materials.
We've had people with skin cancers. Pulmonary things are very prevalent. You know, it's a whole array of things.
After 2 decades of cleanup, the EPA declared the remediation of Yerevan wrapped up in 2008. But this empty field that used to be a town was never taken off the list. Why? Because the agency says it needs further investigation and study before giving it a clean bill of health. Colorado's Department of Public Health recently submitted comments to the EPA saying the agency's continued work in Yerevan is duplicative, costly, and causing delay. It seems to be the kind of thing Administrator Pruitt is looking to streamline. Still, Jane Thompson doesn't hold out any hope the Yerevan site will ever totally be out of the hands of the federal government.
Well, I think it will remain forever.
But she wants to keep having these annual reunion picnics, where the real star of the show is the dessert.
I want you all to make sure you get over here and get a picture of yourself with the yellow cake.
An actual yellow cake, with yellow frosting and black radioactive signs on top. Yerevan residents may have lost their town, but not their sense of humor. For Inside Energy, I'm Dan Boyce.
That piece comes to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. Coming up, local governments want to raise more money, and the Wyoming Department of Education is phasing out a program to support migrant students. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. On Tuesday, city council members and others will converge on the legislature's Joint Revenue Committee to suggest ways that communities could raise more money for themselves. Lawmakers are worried about maintaining local government funding due to the downturn in the energy economy and because of education funding needs. Wyoming Association of Municipalities Director Rick Kaysen joins us to say that if local governments could raise more money internally, it could address budget uncertainty.
The concern going forward is being able to make sure that the services that municipalities provide and really encapsulated, that's public safety, health, welfare, as well as other services, is being able to ensure that those funds that are needed to provide those expected services and in some cases even enhanced services are there. We have been able to, over decades of time, been able to benefit from the funds coming in from the mineral industry. Again, back to uncertainty. How long are we going to be able to rely on that extracted industry for those revenues, which we've been able to, like I say, benefit for many decades? And what we're asking for consideration as we talk to legislators, how about some local authority for municipalities to be able to generate funds that will provide some certainty, some stability, so we can plan for the future as well, not only for the existing services, but looking down the pike, if I may, for what the communities need to make not only their community strong, but Wyoming as a whole strong.
So you'd like to see that maybe not be so volatile for everyone.
What might be available for municipalities to utilize to raise local revenues? And of course, one of those components of this is certainly the transparency and helping educate and inform and having the vote of the people to assess taxes against themselves. So it's just not a one-sided dictatorial type of thing of me. So again, the flexibility is very key in this. And when we take a look at some of our larger cities compared to our smaller towns, many of our smaller towns just do not have a retail base to see an increase in or some realization of sales and use taxes because they just don't have the base. And across Wyoming, many of our municipalities are the smaller towns. But if you take some of our larger cities, they have the capability of doing this. So that's why we refer to this as the options or the tools in the toolkit, what might work best for different sized communities.
What are some of the options that some of the communities have shared with you that they'd like to maybe have an opportunity to implement?
Is the revision of some tax laws. For example, municipal sales and use tax options. There perhaps could be a sliding scale. And by that I mean if the state does very well on its sales and use tax, maybe some of those dollars could be then redistributed back into municipal or local government as well, instead of the current formula that we currently have. We're asking for some consideration and possibility of property tax revisions. Currently in the state of Wyoming, those property taxes are created and assessed by at the county level. Many states allow municipal government to make some property taxes locally within the municipality. Another option that we are asking to be considered is increasing the state sales tax from 4% to 5%.
Should be an interesting conversation, Rick Kaysen. A pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to share. And we look forward to trying to help our state move forward. A strong Wyoming, meaning strong municipalities.
Farmworker families often have to migrate from state to state to find work, and that makes school challenging for their kids. For over 40 years, the Wyoming Department of Education has run a program to support this vulnerable student population. But that has now come to an end. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson looks at why.
On a tour of the farmland surrounding Torrington, Wyoming, Simon Lozano remembers a time when these fields were bustling with the sugar beet harvest.
It was like 90% beets.
But now, after driving about 5 miles outside of town, we've passed only one beet field, and we haven't seen a soul out working the land.
Back in the heyday, you would have seen a lot of workers.
Oh gosh, yeah. You'd see people out working in the heat of the day, all day.
Lozano spent 30 years working as a teacher in Torrington. His students came from families who owned and worked these farms. In fact, before he was born, his own family migrated from Mexico up to Wyoming to work the land.
I spent some time thinning beets and weeding beans as a kid. I can remember, as a fourth grader, I think, fifth grader, looking down a row of beets thinking, I'm never going to get to the end.
But Lozano's time in the fields was short. Unlike many farmworker families who have to migrate from harvest to harvest, Lozano's grandpa found permanent work on a ranch. That allowed Lozano to settle into a school district and focus on his studies. Soon after starting his career as a high school language arts teacher, he was recruited to help run a federally funded initiative called the Migrant Education Program. Lozano says migrant kids would show up in late April, and he knew their families had migrated before they could finish up their school year.
Their regular school education was interrupted a lot, and so we just tried to fill the gaps.
Lozano knows firsthand that farmworkers are in the fields sun up to sun down, doing back-breaking labor to get the crops harvested. So their kids need extra support.
We had kids from birth through high school in those early years, but we would enroll around 200 kids. So it was quite a program. It really was.
In addition to Torrington, there were also sites in Powell and Worland. At the program's height, there were about 900 migrant students statewide. But by 2008, that number dropped to 246. Lozano attributes this to several factors. Beets are now bioengineered to require less weeding, and machines can do the harvesting, so human hands are no longer in high demand. And Wyoming struggles to compete with the low price of imported sugar, forcing many beet farmers to abandon the industry altogether. For the last several years, just over 100 migrant students have been officially recorded statewide. And as a result, this year, the WDE decided not to reapply for federal funds to support migrant students. That makes Wyoming just one of four states without a migrant education program. And that was hard news for Lozano to hear.
I think it shows very little forethought, compassion.
Farmworker families have the lowest annual income in the U.S., and studies show that nationally, less than 50% of migrant students graduate from high school. So, even though the numbers have dwindled, Lozano is certain there are still migrant students in the state who need support. But officials say the decision was motivated by more than a decline in enrollment. Joanne Nemoto directed the program for the WDE until it ended. She says for Wyoming, there was concern that the migrant education program required the exchange of too much student information.
The migrant student information exchange, which we called M6, did not meet the contractual standards with third-party accessibility.
There was a worry that individuals outside of the migrant education program could access data on migrant students, but she wouldn't say who. I floated this concern by Sandy Peterson, who directs North Dakota's program and who has worked in migrant education for over 30 years. What's your sense of the conversation amongst directors about M6? Are other people wary of it?
No. That sounds like an excuse. But no, you know, when you have a migrant program, you have to have a migrant database.
Peterson says the information in the database helps teachers down the road pick up where students left off, things like reading and math assessment scores and grades. I also checked in with Dr. Bill Bansberg, who coordinates a migrant literacy program in 11 different states. He says heavily guarding migrant student data is standard practice.
This is something that is drilled into every single migrant program from the U.S. Office of Migrant Ed. All of this data, you know, needs to be password protected. It needs to be confidential.
For Bansberg, it's more important to provide continuity in education than to worry about overprotecting student data.
I mean, because somebody doesn't want to fill out the paperwork? I mean, is that it? I mean, really? That's the reason you're not going to have a program?
Bansberg is surprised Wyoming wouldn't take the $200,000 allotted by the federal government and would give up the opportunity to support migrant students who pass through the state, no matter how few there are now. Dickie Shaner is the Wyoming Department of Education Chief of Staff. He says limiting data sharing is a strong enough priority for the state to forego that funding.
And so in this situation where the amount of money we were to receive from the federal government and the population that it was intended to help really was down to a very small number of students, and we did not believe it was necessary to accept that federal money.
But Nevada and New Hampshire, who also have just over 100 migrant students, are continuing their programs. In an upcoming story, I'll explore how they're making that work. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Central Wyoming College in Riverton sits in a very unique spot in the state, right next door to the Wind River Indian Reservation. Many of its students are Native American. But now, the school is stepping up to do even more for the tribal community and are well underway in designing a program to educate future Native leaders. But that's not all the Institute for Tribal Leadership will do. I talked with CWC President Brad Tyndall and the college's Tribal Education Coordinator Ivan Posey about their plans.
Well, basically, the Institute of Tribal Learning is building upon this beautiful building that we have. It's the Intertribal Education Community Center. And what it really needs now is to really go to the next level and expand programming into three big areas. One would be leadership development for tribal members. Two, outreach to all populations on all things American Indian. And last piece, but very important, is student success in a realm where student success is very much needed. One of the things I'm really excited about is really our, what we call our Tribal Wisdom Society program, which is really leadership development. And I think it's radically new and very interesting and exciting for a national model in terms of a new leadership model that's really culturally contextualized and very relevant, and not the same old leadership programs that teach you management and you network a little bit with people. So I don't know, maybe Ivan can explain that
My take on that is, you know, there's very little information out there, whether it's in our tribal communities or off the reservation, about the structure and the history and the contemporary issues of tribal government, tribal history. And this program would actually introduce and allow young people to learn a little bit more of the history, government structure. But part of that would also include that they would contribute something back to the community. We don't know what that could be. Maybe it's a project that they do, and it's not just a freebie, I guess, per se, but that they actually could contribute some back to the tribal community.
Because you're so centrally located there, it seems like a great place to really bring together the tribal community there. And so I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about how this kind of developed and what the needs are there on Wind River Indian Reservation.
Well, as you may know, this is Ivan, and I served 20 years on our tribal council. And I came here, I actually resigned to come to work for the college here, but it's something that I've always thought about over the years to develop an institute where people could learn more about us. You know, a lot of times we're viewed as somebody from the past, as tribal people, and we're here, we're contemporary. I mean, there's a little over 2 million of us in a country of 330 million, but we're still upheld by treaties and the history and all these other things that makes us so unique.
If I could chime in a little bit, locally, I think the vast majority of the population of the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes are under age 25, vast majority. We're talking about a whole new generation of tribal members, and there's going to be this huge gap in leadership. And so in anticipation of this great need for building tribal leaders, not only locally, but nationally, there's this huge opportunity. And many people are just studying at our college. It could be auto mechanics. It could be nursing. And you're saying, how do we make those people future leaders? How do we tap into all backgrounds and provide seminars and trainings and academies so that even a nursing graduate comes out with leadership skills, because they will be the future business council leader? And so it's really a comprehensive look at how do we train everybody and look for leaders in kind of non-traditional venues, regular folk basically, to educate on culture, history, land tenure, water rights, everything that people really need to know.
And it does seem like there's sort of an alignment of the stars going on, you know, with the Indian Education for All Act passing this last legislative session. And it looks like you'll be able to play a role in making sure that that Indian education is out there amongst school children all around the state. What role is the program going to play in that implementation of Indian Education for All?
Well, I think Central Wyoming has a very important role. We have curriculum experts, but we also have the partnerships to bring people together so that we can really put substance to this Native American Education for All in terms of actual learning objects and really pushing things out to people via TV, radio modules, road shows, driving across the country, showing people how to help people integrate these modules into their classrooms. And so, we see that very much a part, an important role that we'll play in the Institute of Tribal Learning is helping bring that together.
Well, I think just from experience, you know, locally, off-reservation and statewide, there is a very limited knowledge of the Wind River Indian Reservation. And for a vast, beautiful state with so small of real communities and small towns, that message should be a little bit easier to get across once it's presented in the right way.
Well, thank you both so much for taking some time to talk to me about your vision for the Institute of Tribal Learning.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
When we come back, a visit to Cody to discuss delisting the grizzly bear. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. After decades of controversy, Yellowstone grizzly bears are now officially under state management in Wyoming. But the debate is not over quite yet. Several conservation groups have filed lawsuits to stop the switch and to keep the once endangered species under federal management. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Paul Miller just got back from a 12-day hunting trip outside of Cody with some friends.
Yeah, we went on a mountain goat and a bighorn sheep hunt. One guy drew both tags and we archery hunted it for a couple days and then hunted sheep with a rifle.
There, he saw 15 grizzly bears. Miller says he's excited at the possibility of one day soon being able to hunt a bear. Conversations about trophy hunting jump-started this month as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officially removed the grizzly from the endangered species list. Miller is one of many in town who agree it's about time the animal be put under state management.
When you can go into one drainage and you don't travel more than, I don't know, 2 or 3 miles each way and you can find 20 or 15 grizzly bears, I'd say that it's time to manage them a little better because they're just thick and you're just asking for people to get hurt.
The grizzly bear was listed as an endangered species in 1975. The controversy over its listing started closer to 2003, though, when the population surpassed the recovery criteria set by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In 2007, the Yellowstone grizzly was actually delisted, but federal protections were restored following a lawsuit that ended in 2009. Under federal management, it's harder to put down problem bears. Residents say there's an increasing number of bears getting closer to town, hunting is prohibited, and for many, there's also the simple gut reaction.
It's our wildlife, it's within Wyoming's boundaries. We have a great team here that knows how to manage it and doesn't need to have Big Brother looking over their shoulder.
That's Lee Livingston, a Park County commissioner and an outfitter. He does stand to benefit. Hunting grizzlies is allowed. He's walking into the courthouse in downtown Cody. He thinks this battle is still a ways from being over.
I say a lot of folks are probably still holding their breath. Been there, done it, seen it. We're not going to say it's done until it's done.
This month, more than 10 groups have filed or joined lawsuits against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, arguing the decision to remove the grizzly from the endangered species list is premature and could lead to their decline. Those include Sierra Club, the Northern Cheyenne Tribe, and the Western Watersheds Project. Livingston obviously opposes the litigation.
They're doing well, and now they're grasping at straws to litigate under anything they can find. And the latest round of litigation, I think, shows that.
Litigants say that there's been a troubling drop in the Yellowstone bears population recently, with more than 60 bears dying between 2014 and 2016. With dwindling food sources as well, they argue it's not the time to take away protections, let alone allow hunting to begin. Chuck Neal, a longtime Cody resident, is disappointed by those who want to allow hunting, especially in the outskirts of grizzly habitat.
That's exactly the wrong attitude, and it will be guaranteed to stop recovery in its tracks.
Neal says the only way to properly recover the grizzly is to allow them to move and settle between different habitats, like in Glacier National Park. Neal says that means bears in the periphery of Yellowstone are the most valuable.
Because they are the ones that are pioneering out, trying to recolonize historically occupied contiguous habitat.
Neal says federal regulation has allowed grizzlies the safety of making a slow and steady rebound. But the work isn't done.
We are snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory because we are getting that close. We're getting close, and we're going to guarantee it's never going to take place.
Director of the Draper Natural History Museum, Dr. Charles Preston, has lived in Cody for 19 years and has watched the controversy unfold. He says the change shouldn't be seen as a death sentence or a miracle, but an opportunity.
This is the end of one chapter, that chapter of long-term protection and recovery that we should be celebrating. And it's the beginning of another chapter, and that chapter is management and conservation of the grizzly bears.
As for the lawsuits, it is possible they could stop the delisting of the grizzly bear, but it will take many more years to resolve. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
The classic 1950s musical Guys and Dolls gave us Frank Sinatra throwing dice and crooning "Luck Be a Lady Tonight" in a fedora. The comedy is a staple of community and high school theater and has seen numerous Broadway revivals over the years. Playwright Mark Saltzman is now looking to add to that legacy with his companion musical, Another Roll of the Dice, which premiered at the Wyoming Theater Festival this week. His show reunites the music of Frank Lesser and the stories of author Damon Runyon, the original minds behind Guys and Dolls. Saltzman told Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard his own creative interest was sparked when he was a teenager reading Runyon's stories.
I loved Guys and Dolls, and I also that led me really as a teenager to read Damon Runyon stories. Cut to decades later, and I'm getting a call from the Damon Runyon estate. My heart kind of flip-flopped, and the fella said, well, you know, if you have any ideas for a way to use any of these stories, we're into it. And I thought, well, you know, how about with Frank Lester songs and doing a kind of Guys and Dolls companion piece with a small cast, and instead of just one story for the show, how about three separate short stories like sitcom episodes? And they were into it, and I got to reread every story Damon Runyon wrote, including some unpublished. They were very kind about that. And it could not have been a happier couple of weeks of my life.
How does Another Roll of the Dice fit in with Guys and Dolls? Are there any crossover plots or characters?
There's crossover food. If you remember in Guys and Dolls, the cheesecake and strudel at Mindy's Deli, that comes back, and Mindy's Deli comes back as a place of operation for all the gangsters. There aren't any characters that are in the same place, but they're in the same world as Nathan Detroit and Skye Masterson.
What was it like to work with the material of Damon Runyon and Frank Lesser and working with those estates?
Oh, well, the material is a joy on both sides. The Runyon stories, we kind of think of them as comedy because of Guys and Dolls, but there's a lot more to it. There's one of the stories I selected was surprisingly feminist, even aggressively feminist for its time, which was the 30s. And there were some other ones that I didn't use that had a kind of darker, more sorrowful kind of feel about living in this world of criminals. And the Lesser people, the way we arranged things, Frank Lesser wrote a lot of Broadway musicals and a lot of pop songs. Maybe the most famous of the pop songs is Heart and Soul or Two Sleepy People. And it was agreed that I'd only use the freestanding pop songs rather than songs from his musicals. And once we had that agreement and understanding, everything was smooth because I knew just what they wanted and which songs to go to.
Guys and Dolls, the movie, is a classic. Frank Sinatra, Marlon Brando, and it's also a staple. A lot of community theater puts this on. But has there been any pressure for you to have something that, you know, might be compared to Guys and Dolls?
I feel like having Damon Runyon as the wind in my sails, it kind of can't help but be, through no fault of my own, but I'm leaning on two giants. And my job is, I feel, to keep my head down and stay out of their way, and it will be just as good. So I don't stress about that. I feel pretty confident that if I just minimize myself, these guys will do the greatness that they always did.
The show is currently in development, and as I understand it, a version of it premiered in California a couple of years ago. So what can audiences at the Wyoming Theater Festival expect?
Oh, no, this is the first time it'll be in front of an audience in Wyoming. The in California, we did a workshop that was, I guess, invited people and friends. It was just kind of to get a feeling of the flow and what songs and what needed to be cut. This is really the first time they won't be reading scripts. They'll be in costume. It's a full production. So this really is the roll of the dice here at the Wyoming Theater Festival.
What are you looking forward to most about having this go up at the Wyoming Theater Festival?
The audience reaction. I'll find out if these jokes really are funny in the definition of making people laugh, and the ones that do well and the stories that do well will stay in, and the things we have to cut will get cut. But it's only an audience that can tell us that. In rehearsal or in workshops, you speculate. You think, oh, I think that'll do well with the audience. But until really, really the bodies are in the room reacting, we're only guessing, and this will be the first time we have that actual experience.
What are your ultimate hopes for another roll of the dice?
We'd kind of like it to be a standard in American theater, the way Guys and Dolls is, that this would be the companion, and the people who have all this affection for half a century towards Guys and Dolls would get another taste. We're saying that this is kind of the piece of cheesecake after the meal at the deli.
Mark Saltzman will be premiering another Roll of the Dice at the Wyoming Theater Festival. Mark, it's been a lot of fun speaking with you.
Same here. Same here. Okay, take care.
The Wyoming Theater Festival runs through September 17th in Sheridan.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed any part of the show, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org or sign up for our podcast on that site or on iTunes.
You can also listen to individual segments on our website or pitch good ideas for future stories. Anna Rader is our web editor.
This is the time of year where we ask you to support Wyoming Public Radio with a financial contribution that helps our reporters travel the state and bring you the stories you appreciate. We thank you for that support. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.